He lives in my house. Eric lives in my house. If you want to advantage of a dot matrix, you can send a. You can make an email. I can accommodate. It's a matter of programming. You need to download characters. But in. I don't know that. There's the guy who's in the comment already. I talked to the guy now.
Since last fall, when I first time I
sent it in, Kaufner writing up Hebrew.
And had her go through an ad.
Oh, on the screen?
Now it's the final.
There's not up the screen. I don't know about the screen. I know a print.
Well, like, so we have Swedish characters.
Oh, yeah.
We don't have. Well, they lay on the screen, they come up with brackets and funny things, you know.
No.
Eric Green, that's Eric Green's new form of Calvinism.
Oh!
No, it's probably 311, brother.
No, I know.
Yeah. If you read Calvinism into it, that's your problem.
Don't you remember that when you used to hear that day that he said, I think I might become a semi-Calvin?
Oh, yeah, in a constant relationship would probably be...
Semi-Calvin?
Yeah. Yeah, I think
he used to be a hyper-anti-Calvin.
That's
Rothman. Oh, that's Rothman?
Okay,
yeah, he said. Okay, so that's probably the A heart of the key. Yeah. There
is even a question. I
New type of Hebrew.
I wish everybody was here because I want to make an announcement on this next quiz, the grammar test. Which I hope you'll enjoy the announcement. These chapters, when I looked through, I thought I submitted the test for this to the printing, and I hadn't. And I realized when I looked to find out why I hadn't is because I never had one written. And the reason I had never had one written is because of the nature of these four chapters. They're all peculiar details with these verb forms.
Yeah.
So there's no real grammar here. And so what I'm going to do on this test, I could just give you all kinds of microscopic forms.
Oh, yeah.
But that's not really going to be effective. Because,
especially since we're going to forget them over the summer.
Yeah, forget them over the summer. And those aren't the things you remember. What I want to do is test you on the thing that we want you to learn out of this class, and that's translating. So what we're going to do is you'll be responsible for the reading sections of those four exercises. Mm. What I'm going to do is just give you, I'm going to photocopy it right out of here. I don't think I'll have any copyright problems because we all have the book. But if I do, we'll just have to, don't worry about it. We'll use that textbook to say, they copied it for your own purpose. But that's what we did. We're just going to do it. The only reason I do that, because some of you probably put notes in your book there. And I don't want to just have it. We could work from the book, but I just don't want you to have that attempt in there. So what I'll do is you'll be responsible for all of the, those readings. It's pretty short. The total amount of it isn't that much. But I'm just going to give you a photocopy of part of that and have you translate it in English. And you'll have the footnotes also. I'll give you these footnotes on these grammatical points we haven't had yet. So that way... You still have to recognize those verb forms and so forth, but you've been through it once, and this is the kind of test we're going to have in the second year a lot. Only it'll be a portion of scripture. I'll just say, 1 Kings chapters 1, 2, and 3, be responsible for this translation test. And it'll be something we've already gone through. Proactive is something we've seen before. But we'll go through things in class and translating, and then I'll give you quizzes on there. That's the kind of thing we really want to learn how to do.
It's coming up
test. The grammar test next Friday, week from today, is going to be just a translation test, translating into English from Hebrew those four sections. I won't give you the whole thing to translate, probably, it takes much time. You should be responsible for all of it. So what I would do is just review your, notes that we went through in class on it, and just review this. What this will do is force you to be able to recognize these verb forms in their context. And that's what we're really going to be doing later anyway.
As we've gone through, I've kind of has noticed the literal but wrote it out idiomatically. And in the test, will idiomatic translation be good enough?
That would be good enough as long as it's the right idiomatic translation.
But I feel like it might even be easier to do it just literal.
Yeah.
It's probably easier, but
what
you
I would do,
do what it meant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's true, too. If you do it literal, you may not even know what the idiom is. So what I'd like you to do there is give me a good translation of it. And sometimes you can put in parentheses the literal. Just, you know, if you want to make sure that I know that you saw it right. Say, if, you know, if you feel you might be getting a little too loose with your paraphrase, then put the literal in parentheses so I know where you're coming from. That way it will resolve any problems. Okay. Does that sound like an easier task or a harder task?
That sounds much easier.
Because, I mean, really, there are so many little complications here. And then when your occipitated forms are different than the others and so forth, it's really not worth it, especially with a lot of the paradigms aren't even complete, and there's only a few of the tested forms and so forth. I think it's far more efficient for our purposes rather than beat our brains trying to do all of that. It's going to leak out anyway. You're not going to keep it that long. Okay. I'd rather get you oriented toward recognizing forms than a lot of these details. It's still going to be you still can't bluff your way through. You still got to know what that is. And there's too much here probably to memorize it all. You know, so you have to, you know, if you've got a real good memory, I suppose you could memorize all the reading sections. But that's probably, you know, you're going to learn something by doing that too. You want to do it that way. But I wish you should go through and make sure that you understand everything, you know, and if there's a part that's difficult, memorize that part, you know, the parts that are easy that you can know you can get. Don't worry about those parts. Just zero in on the parts that are hard. And I think you'll find it. Right, chapter 29, 30, 31, 32. And only that section on reading, so each of those four sections. And I'll be giving you a photocopy of portions of that, and I'll probably take part of one, part of the other, something, and then have you translate it for me.
That's my whole test.
Yeah, that's just going to be. That's all the test will be.
That sounds like fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's fun in the way that this is what we're really here for.
Amen.
So, and you're going to find that through the rest of the book, we're going to have to orient ourselves more that way, because we're not going to have so much pure grammar anymore. Even the grammar we do have is going to be oriented toward clause relationships and so forth, and there the only way to see what's happening is by translating a sentence. So that's the direction we'll be taking next year. Almost all your tests next year will be that way.
Are we going to have to do English to Hebrew?
No, only be Hebrew to English.
I don't know whether to say whee.
Well, I know it's
still going to be awful tough because now it's you know, I mean, you're not getting, you know, I don't know.
Well,
there's a lot more there.
Yeah, there's a lot of material there, but I think one thing is it lets you find out how much Hebrew you really do know. I mean, there's a lot of little details.
I've noticed we've learned a lot more than we think we have.
Yeah.
I just pick up the
information. By the way, I told you before that I thought we got into chapter 35 last time, but I think we only got to about chapter 30, 29 or 30. So we're several chapters ahead.
Yeah, you planned to get to somewhere between 35 and 40.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was shooting for.
Yeah.
And we'll make it right up to 30, but we're through 34 almost now.
Nice.
We're halfway through it, so we're doing pretty well.
How much review is that?
37.
I'm going to run through
it. Yeah, that review I may shorten up a little bit too, because now that I told what's there, I think we'll just go through and take questions and you can just note the forms, but. We're not going to go into a lot of detail.
The readings don't
involve a lot. Right. The main problem you're going to have is recognizing a verb form. You can usually tell it's a long consecutive form, but the trouble you get into is maybe it was a one-year-old, maybe it was a one-noon, maybe it was, you know. So that's the thing. And it's also recognizing these apocopated forms. You know, I mean, you're still not going to get off the hook completely on this, of course, because you've got to recognize them. But it will help a lot because. When it's all said and done, what you're going to be doing when you're translating Hebrew is the same thing when you're doing the test. Hoping you're looking for recognition and so forth, and you're trying to develop habit patterns rather than orient toward pyramids. So I think that'd be a more fair way to handle it. Because in trying to write up a test, the only way I could write one up is either give translation, which I'm going to do here, or emphasize all these paradigms, all these irregular verbs, and that's not the way to go. I mean, that would be forcing me to emphasize the wrong things, because, you know, really your understanding of Hebrew is going to be more dependent on your understanding of grammar rather than all these specific irregularities. You just need to be more familiar what irregularities do exist. When you run across one, what options to check? Because I've probably never seen.
So for the rest of our duration in this class next year, we're going to be able to get real proficient at the text.
Yes, that's what we're working for. And then in the second year, many of your tests, at least at first, we'll have to still be sticking with the book pretty much. But as we go, we're going to be, you'll be having tests on portions of scripture right from the text. So you'll have to have your text. If you haven't got one of those, let's see, we need to have one that doesn't have any English in it.
The black.
So yeah, the little black one, Snape, whatever it is, the editor.
Snape, yeah.
Yeah. If you get a copy of that, or you can, that's probably a better print for the money.
Yeah.
Biblia Breaka would be excellent too if you've got one. Yeah. You've already got one. They were having a sale on it. That would be good too. That's got apparatus.
You know, this
little guy is funny.
There's this other book too, this Hebrew translation of the New Testament. It makes a very useful review because you're not familiar with phrases or anything.
Mm.
Black one.
Oh, Hebrew of the New Testament?
Yeah.
Okay.
One of them is about for the Jews. It's got the text on one side and it's
which way is which?
Yeah. It's got your English on one side and your Hebrew on the other.
Yeah.
So you can actually, I was sitting here and I was reading through and I would try to translate just off of here because I would not be familiar with any of these narratives or anything I looked
mm-hmm.
at before I go the other direction and it's made for good practice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That'd be good for exercise purposes. But for test purposes and so forth,
yeah, well,
you've got to have one of those with no English in it. So, you know, I'd just say go from the text portion of it. I'll tell you ahead of time what to be responsible.
Are you familiar with Jack with the Hebrew Publishing Company? Yeah.
I don't know if I think I'm familiar with the text. I saw some things they had for.
I got one, so I'm helping you.
Yeah, okay. Well, bring it and we'll take a look at it. See, main thing, all of these are going to be Masoretic texts, so your essential text isn't going to be any different. The Biblia Breaka has got more apparatus in it, but the main thing we're interested in is print quality and readability. Some of them, like Jay Green's, is real poor print quality. It's
yeah.
about the worst I've seen.
Yeah.
Sometimes the vowel point isn't even there, it doesn't show up, or half there, or something like that. But it's pretty poor.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's an interlinear, so I don't want you to use an interlinear. But, it could
be true. The problem is that I think it's photo-reproduced, and that's what the problem
is. Oh,
yeah.
That's what it looks like.
Poor photo-reproduction.
Yeah.
I don't know where it came from.
It's just like, you know, parts of it are faded out. So
uh-huh.
This little snake one is real good, and the leg break is good, break is about the best. If you've got one of those, that's the best thing to have. If you intend to do a lot of scholars in the future, it might be wise investment. But it's going to cost you more. What were they selling you for here?
They're about
$20.
$23.
That's not too bad. Okay. Do you still
have them in the bookstore? We can't American Lab to
that. Oh, okay.
Do you have any there right now?
They didn't order
them. They didn't order them.
Okay.
What price do you have any over there right now?
No.
We got all the little ones that have snakes got.
Mm-hmm.
They're $8.20.
$8.20?
Okay.
So the little ones, they just fine, and it's got real good print quality. Well, so that'll maybe take a little load off your mind. They still have the vocab quiz as normal. That'll be on Wednesday, and then the grammar quiz will be a translation test. So be sure to let anybody know it's not here, just to forget to say something about it. Okay.
Do on your own, Jim.
What's that?
Somebody has informed me after class here. We made a change in the grammar test coming up.
Oh.
It's going to be essentially a translation because of the nature of the subject matter in these four chapters. It's all details or paradigms. So we're going to give you an easier test. You just need to know. I'm going to give you sections from the readings. Let's translate
them. That's
exactly what I wanted. Is it? I think so. You've been suffering long
time going out to your day. He's been interceding for the last time. He cried out with a cold, but.
So, hey.
Got it all.
Okay, well, let's go back to lesson 34 then.
John?
Jim?
Oh. And this way we'll get some more cover because we won't have to do Harding review that. We'll see. I'll go through and review whatever you need to. And if there are any portions of those translations that you didn't get written down accurately, then you want to make sure your translations that you have in your exercises are accurate so you're not learning something wrong in the first place. Okay. We're on page 158. We've just looked at the paradigms for passive participle and infinitive absolute. And we're talking about the meaning of the passive participle on top of page 158. The stem forms as given above call for a little comment. Note the furtive comment. Okay, we've read that. Now, and as an adjective, the participle is tenseless, but bears the connotation of completed action. So it's got a completed action type of connotation. Now see, an adjective itself is just describing something, and it's describing something with reference to a verbal action. And so it doesn't really have a tense idea to it. But it's usually got completed action simply because if you're able to describe something by a verbal action, that verbal action must have already taken place, or you wouldn't be able to describe it anymore. You know what I mean? In other words, for example, the plain man is, you know, if you're going to use it this way, if you're going to use it as a participle, which functions as an adjective, and modify the man by the adjective plain, I mean, it's got to happen. And they will modify
the being killed man.
Yeah, the being killed man. I suppose if he's in the process of being slain, you can describe it that way. But actually, if you want to say the man who will be slain or something, then you'll use a relative clause, and you'll do that differently. So,
where's the relative participle for the being slain?
I don't know if you'd use this passive. This passive participle, like I say, could be that or the other. You see here, the man is, was, has been slain.
Regular participle.
Oh, yes, you could use a regular participle, and actually what you'd actually use there would be a nifal participle, where to get the passive idea of being slain and to get this progressive aspect both, then you'd use a nifal participle. We haven't got nifals yet, but nifal is the passive of the call, and this guy is more of a, this passive participle here, it's really a call passive participle, and it's a little bit different kind of thing than the nifal participle. It's got more weight on the adjective than it's got on the verb. Let's put it that way. So that's why this tense idea doesn't become so important. It's mainly that the action is completed. Okay, so the plain man. In English, therefore, a relative clause with a perfect or preterite verb is often required in translation. So we'll usually use a past tense verb of some sort, either perfect or preterite, no past tense. So ha'ish keharug, the slain man, or the man who was slain. Perhaps the man who is slain. But if he is slain, he is slain. You know, he's dead. It's not so much he is being slain. That would be done with a little bit different construction, like I mentioned. The written book, ha'sefer ha'kathud. The written book, or the book which was written. And the participle as a predicate adjective has the same properties as other adjectives in this position. For example, Aish Haru, the man is, was, has been slain. Now, you've got no article on the participle, so that puts it in the predicate position. And so then you supply a form of the verb to be, the man is, was, or has been slain. And context will have to decide whether it is slain, was slain, or has been slain.
Question.
Mm-hmm.
On the previous examples, they use the past tense in there, and I know, but if you put is, I mean, is there any reason why you could not say which is the book which is written? I mean, the two of them, they focus on somewhat different aspects.
Yeah.
And is there anything in the Hebrew that indicates one way or the other?
I don't really think so. The book which is written is just as good as the book which was written, because in English it's still a perfect, it's completed action. The book is written, in other words, it was written at some point in the past, but it is now abiding in the state of having been written.
Yeah, whereas was is more focusing on the fact that of the writing of it,
right,
and is right. Focusing on the fact that it exists,
right, and the result, the result of it.
Yeah,
and I guess it's the same thing as this down here. This context is going to have to be
okay,
but I wouldn't. Yeah.
Could you explain the
Well, see, the present participle would be, well, see, we don't really have, what we had before was just a participle. We didn't call it present or anything. We just called it a participle, remember. And the present idea is you're getting from context. In Greek, of course, you have present participle. So you have to be more tense distinction there.
Is that what that nipal? Nipal was that participle?
Well, yes. The nipal would give you a passive idea and still give you more of a...
Is it being written?
Yeah, the more of the kind of an aspect that we had before. See, you know, we tend to call it present participle. It's got the kind of an idea it was getting. It was just talking about the verbal action associated with the thing without really an emphasis on time. So normally you get this progressive aspect. The progressive aspect, I think, is the best way to describe it. And but see, this is now passive of that. See, before we have the man is writing, the writing man, or something like that, the man who is writing or something. There you use that participle we had before. But now this is something that was written. It is written. And so the difference here is this is passive, it was active. But as far as... and this is another difference, too, is this doesn't seem to be emphasizing progressive aspect like the other one did. They'll use a nipal participle to get that progressive aspect out of it. And just it's something analogous to the participle we already have. So the problem you're dealing with is that it's so easy when you see a term like passive participle to try to project it into the understanding you have for Greek for passive participle, and it just doesn't quite match up. I wish it did, but it doesn't.
It's more arid.
Yeah, maybe a little bit more arid. Yeah, it's got an indefinite aspect, although either aorist or almost perfect. It's almost got the idea that action was completed and it's got a present result of the other completed action. Okay. And really, there isn't much between the man is slain, the man was slain, the man has been slain. In English, it's a very slight shade of difference between those. And in Hebrew, they're not making a distinction. And in context, they make a distinction, but not the phrase itself. So it gains its tense from the context in which it occurs and not from the participle itself. The participle is not giving that kind of information. Okay, the addition of a prepositional phrase to express an agent, as in the man who was slain by his enemy, is virtually unknown in Hebrew. They just don't set up things that way. They'll express agency more in a much more direct fashion. But like any adjective, it may be in construct with the following qualifying noun. So adjectives can function like nouns, of course, and nouns are often in construct of other nouns. And so an adjective can be in construct with another noun. And since the passive participle is an adjective in form, it can also occur in such a position. Now, I should maybe note before we look at this example that this passive participle does decline. You see, you've got feminine, just like any other adjective. Remember, your adjective, you had a masculine form, a feminine form with a comma T, and this would have a comma T in the feminine form. And you've got kathu, that would be kathuva, you know, shawa in the first syllable, propionic reduction, and a comma T. So that would be a common, you know, and then kithuvim and kithuvol.
That's the
same with the regular particle. Same with the regular particle. Exactly. So you just didn't note that here. I just thought I'd remind you of that before we look at this example, because this one has a feminine forming construct. So ear, sumufa, ash, a city which has been burned with fire. Okay, so you have a city, and then you have this adjective in construct, this passive participle in construct, the feminine form of the participle in construct. Remember, in construct, a comma te will turn to papa, cow. So that's what's happened here. In other words, the form was surufa, then it comes surufa in construct. And so what they're saying is a city which has been burned of fire. See, a city burned of fire. That's what it literally is. So that's the way they do it. In other words, they're not going to use a prepositional phrase for the to express agent, but city burned of fire, and the agent would be expressed with a construct relationship. That's not entirely unlike Greek. Remember, in Greek, you call with a genitive. They use the genitive to indicate the agent in a direct agency type of situation. They do use a preposition unlike Hebrew, but they do have genitive, and your construct relationship is analogous to the genitive in Greek. So a city burned with fire. And a fire is the thing that burned the city. Okay, well, this is a little bit more like an indirect agent. Somebody probably started fire. Okay, yes, sir.
You know, it's feminine or feminine,
the gold towel. There may be in some of these that end in the, they don't give a complete paradigm, but if it ends in a guttural or something, you might see something like that. No, maybe not. Some of the irregular verbs, it's a pretty regular paradigm. See, we had three hays before that did that, and I just want to check here.
Maybe you'll find out.
Yeah, it could be. Doesn't really delineate that here. And I don't recall here. The exercises do have some throws, but I don't know if they give you any that are unusual. Kind of weak in that area, doesn't give a full paradigm. So I can't be certain what they're going to do in every case. That's a possibility. You see, that's a, especially the three hays is what you expect, like a three hay participle before. And but since the participle, passive participle becomes banui, banui, then you can probably still put the ah and the banui ah and so forth, still come out okay, avoid the problem. So that may be what happens. That would only, that'd be the only way I can think of that it would cause constituting a real problem. Of course, so is and I guess that would be a problem. Okay. So we'll just have to kind of put that on hold and see. But it looks like we're going to be right here all the way through. Okay. Then the participle need not be in the construct state. So that will happen too. The first example, we have the participle in construct here. The participle is not in construct. Ish hagur kili hamilchama, a man girded with weapons of war. Okay. Ish hagur, a man girded, and then there's no width stated here or anything else. It's not even a construct. It's just kali, and you almost have to understand it as a kind of a construct relationship, although the form hagur isn't in construct. And so that raises some questions, you know, as to, it's just unusual. But the participle is not in the construct state, but it's functioning like a construct. Probably won't see those usages real common, but you do need to be aware of them in case you run into one. So if you think it ought to be in construct, it doesn't look like it is in construct. In fact, it is not in construct in form. That's probably the reason. Okay, any questions about that? All right, the infinitive absolute. This is a very interesting thing. This is, they call it an infinitive, and you usually think of an infinitive as a verbal noun. And that's, it's got those kind of properties, but the way it's used syntactically is as an adverb. So this is different now. See, the infinitive, when you think of an infinitive in English, you usually think of the infinitive construct, not the infinitive absolute. The infinitive absolute is used more like an adverb. And it doesn't have declension like the other. And its uses, as you'll see here, are more adverbial. They are modifying an existing verb usually. So, but they certainly have verbal properties to them, but they're functioning in the sentence as an adverbial. So, the infinitive absolute, whose forms are given in the preceding paragraph, is not inflected. It is primarily an adverb whose main uses are as follows. So, you see the paradigm there on the previous page for the infinitive absolute. It looks very much like the passive participle, except you've got a colon while instead of a shurik in the last syllable. That's your major difference. Now, when you get down to the 3K, you do have just a colon, and that's about the only variation on that. Okay, now how is it used? Number one, it is placed before or after a finite verbal form to emphasize the verbal idea in some way. So here's another way to get emphasis, is to use an infinitive absolute. And what way is emphasizing it is kind of determined by the context. But the English translation of this construction will vary from context to context, often requiring the use of adverbs such as surely, certainly, or indeed, or the like. So look at this first example. Shamor tishmeru et mitzvotai. Okay? How would you translate that literally? Or can you ascertain how to
keeping,
translate?
Keeping you will keep.
Yes. Keeping you will keep my commandments. kind of the idea of keeping, or to keep you will keep my commandments, or keeping you will keep my commandments. In fact, King James often translates it that way. You know, die and you will die, and so forth. And they're just trying to go literal with it. And that's the idea. You can see, you can sense the emphasis. You know, it's not just you're going to observe it, my commandments, but observing you will observe, and keeping you will keep. So it's adding more force to it. And so he translates it here, you shall indeed observe my commandments.
What if that has any relationship to the plural of majesty idea? The redoubling of
ideas. Well, it may have some relationship to it. You see that repetition for emphasis is real common in Hebrew. Oh, earth, 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 you know, holy, 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 and that type of thing. Not Trinity, but whoa, 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 you know.
Do they have other constructions to double up like that?
Yes, there'll be other things that you'll see, you know, repetition and so forth. And this is probably one of the most common. It's like this with verbs, you know, repeating nouns and especially repeating in parallel phrases, like in poetry, you see lots of parallelisms where the same thing is stated with different words. And again, you know, for more emphasis. They're very common on that. We've got that kind of thing.
Kind of like where it says they are brought down, they are fallen.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And there's also other ways to get emphasis too, using PL forms, intensive forms. And if you use a PL form and then use this infinitive absolute on top of that, I mean, you can really get a very, very intense, you know. In other words, they've got ways to get lots of different degrees of intensity.
Dying in great degrees of misery.
Yeah, right. And even the verbs themselves, you know, verbs for dying or for killing and so forth, they've got, you know, more vicious ones and less vicious ones, you know. It's really something. So, quite an emotionally oriented language, and that's why Rotherham, you know, many people wonder when they read Rotherham, how does he know where to put those emphasis marks? I mean, how does he know what the emphasis is? But there are keys in both Greek and Hebrew to indicate emphasis. And, we're looking at some of them here. So he says, you shall indeed observe my commandments, or surely you shall see, or certainly, but literally, keeping you will keep. Or in the next example, Imra O Tir Et Bo'oni Amataka, if you will indeed look upon the affliction of your maidservant. Okay, again, if looking you will look, literally, upon. And that's a real literal translation, but I like you to see it so that you're getting a kind of a feeling of the Hebrew coming across. And I don't mind if you translate it indeed, so for a case like this, but if you want to go ahead and translate it literal, I don't have any trouble with that at all. Okay, the more usual position is before the verb, as above. So the more common, you're going to see the infinitive absolute in front of the verb. And that puts the emphasis right from the very beginning. You see that infinitive absolute, you know you're talking about something emphatic. If the verb is used intransitively, the infinitive absolute may follow. It won't always, but you may, if in an intransitive verb where there's no object, you'll see it following as well. So, shim'u, shamoa, and uru'u, ra'o. Listen carefully and look carefully, or listening, be listening, or looking, be looking, or something. You know, you've got a double emphasis there. In this case, the infinitive absolute follows because both verbs are intransitive. But that's not a hard and fast rule. You just see it that way, intransitive. Then, similar to the preceding, is a sequence of two infinitive absolute complementing a finite verb. The two infinitives are often antithetical in meaning. Okay, let's look at this example so we can see what's happening. Wayelek alok wa'afo. Okay, what we have here is the verb halak in the wa consecutive form, and he walked, and then we have the infinitive absolute for halak, which would be halol, and then the infinitive absolute for akal, which would be akol. So literally what we have is, and he walked, walking and eating. And we have two infinitive absolutes, halok and akol, both modifying walking, the first verb walk. So we have, he walked walking and eating. And that's where they got walked along. You see, he walked walking, you know. and it really gives you a progressive aspect to it. He walks, walking, and eating. So this is not an unusual construction. And here's this next example, which is perhaps even more indicative. So we have Wayetse Yatso Washo. And he went back and forth. Literally, he went forth, going forth and returning. And he went forth, going forth and returning. And you can see this picture. It's real graphic. I mean, it's real. the Hebrew is just so beautiful here. It's a graphic picture. You can see the guy going back and forth. You know.
What a heartbeat.
Yeah. So, I mean, it seems like it's got more life to it than the English does. Okay. So, this is again, and this is why I said antithetical very often, because going forth, you see, and going back and forth like this. Walking and eating is too much antithetical with that second example. Okay. Then the third use, instead of emphasizing or complementing the main verb, the infinitive absolute may be used to describe action on a par with the main verb and may be viewed thus as an uninflected substitute for a finite form. That's a little debatable. I don't know. In most of the cases I've seen of it, you could go ahead and translate it as an infinitive and still make some sense out of it, although it does speak a Hebrew idiom again. And his tendency is to try to downplay idiom and bring it across. So, admittedly, in English, you'd probably say it with a finite verb form. But example here we have, es kol de ra'isi, v'nason es levi, l'kol ma'aseh. All this I have seen and I have applied, or literally given my attention, literally heart, to every deed. Now literally it would be all this I have seen to apply or to give. And you see, and to give my attention to every deed. That's a little bit awkward in English. All this I have seen to give, or and to give. It's a little bit strange to us. So they're just saying translated, I have given my attention. And but they're almost, this would be an interesting one to study, because one could easily say in Hebrew, just add it and use the finite verb form to get that. So I have a suspicion that there's a slightly different connotation to this. And the connotation that I seem to sense from the examples that I've seen is that there's almost a kind of a sequential or purposeful relationship. I have seen to give. In other words, all this I have seen to give my attention to every deed. Almost gives a sense that the seeing has affected the person toward giving. And I don't want to say that dogmatically, because we only got one example here, but I think it fits most examples I've seen. And so we'll just have to keep our eye open to that. When we start doing translating, we'll just have to note these infinitive absolutes in places where it looks like this is the case. So I just can't bring myself to believe that this is absolutely the same as if it were a finite verb form. There's got to be some of these connotational differences, some slight shade of meaning difference. Okay. So, admittedly, it'd be a little bit awkward to translate it in a very literal fashion, but I think there's still a theme which you get to that this one to consider. And then, fourthly, this is one perhaps you've got a better case for, although still I think there's some difference here. The use described in 3 gives an almost independent status to the infinitive. For reasons that are quite obscure, instances occur in which the infinitive absolute is used instead of a finite verb, nor is it clearly dependent on any other verb in a given clause. Note the following imperative uses. We've got Shamor es HaMitzvah, observe the entire commandment. Et Kol HaMitzvah, excuse me. Now notice we've got Shamor instead of the imperative here. And to try to translate that literally is something like to observe the entire commandment. And so it doesn't really make sense as a command. And yet, to me, it almost is extending that command to a status of more of a universal principle. I don't know how to describe it.
The third person and personal nouns, or personal verbs.
Yeah, like it is necessary. It is necessary to observe the entire commandment. That's the kind of feeling I get from it, and it kind of broadens, generalizes it, and impersonalizes it in a certain sense. But it makes it more like a universal law of the universe. You know, it is essential to observe the commandment, or it is essential to remember this day, or it is essential to go and cry in the ears of Jerusalem. That's just the feeling I get from it. It's hard to describe it anyway. Yes, Eric.
Have it in Greek too.
Well, remember, the first thing I thought of was, remember that Romans passage, and we just covered it in Greek a few days ago, where they were using an infinitive as an imperative. And there's one other one for you, Jim. Right up paper. Because that may be a Hebrewism just brought right out of the Hebrew. It may not be indicative of Greek normal.
Yeah,
really.
Wouldn't the context really make it much more clear?
Yes, I think so. If you just saw this all by itself, yeah, it would be tougher. But if you're in the context, you see, if you're in the context of God giving laws or something like that, then that's going to pretty well determine what it has to be. Yes, still, the question is why use an infinitive rather than the finite form, an imperative or something. And I think it has to do with the fact that there's more of a broad scale, universal principle involved or something.
And actually, it says like this, you have to put it in the imperative to make a full complete sentence.
Right, yeah.
But if it wasn't isolated, you could defend it.
Well, if it wasn't isolated, if it was part of another sentence, then of course an infinitive is pretty easy to stick in.
Yeah.
But if it's a sentence by itself, then maybe it'll be in the context of other sentences, and that'll set the tenor of it too.
Yeah.
So we'll just have to keep our eyes open for this one too, but it does occur, and I think he's got a pretty good case as far as what he's saying here, except that I don't think it's the same. And he's not really saying that either. It's not the same as if used in imperative, but it's used in a place like an imperative would be used. Okay, so that's very interesting. Infinitive absence is one of the interesting things about Hebrew. It makes Hebrew so unique, you know. You don't see other languages that I know about. Maybe other Semitic languages do this, but none of the other languages I've ever been familiar with spoken like this. Okay. Section 130, the numbers from 3 to 10. There's another little interesting twist. The numbers from 3 to 10 have two forms. A feminine in A, which is used to modify masculine nouns. And an ending with form to use to modify feminine nouns. So you've got to get used to using a feminine adjective to modify masculine nouns here. Yes?
Why does he say that a feminine form in A just because of the ending?
Well, I think that's mainly it.
Because he also makes, for example, the pronouns da is masculine,
yeah,
and feminine.
But I think the reason to say that is because it's following exactly the rules for shortening and everything else that you would for a feminine noun. So it's probably, and maybe it's just, now obviously if it's using modifying masculine noun, grammatically it's not going to be feminine anymore, but formally it's going to be associated with what you saw before. So that way you'll know the rules for forming it, and I guess the main reason. And then an endingless form to modify feminine nouns. Of course, that would be analogous to many of your masculine forms when they didn't have anything. So you kind of got a reversal in at least the formal appearance of these things. And then, of course, another reason to call it feminine is because the construct form does exactly what a feminine construct does. It's the big old tau. It's the orthotok tau in the situation. So that's just like, you know, that's what feminine did. So your eye's going to pick it up as feminine automatically. Okay, so your masculine modifier here, in the absolute, you have shalosha for 3, and construct shaloshet for construct form. We'll see how they're used in a minute. The feminine modifier would be shalosh, and shalosh with shwa for the construct. For the number 4, you've got arba'a for the masculine modifier, which looks in feminine form. And then our ba'at for the construct of that. The feminine modifier would be our ba, and then the construct would be our ba, also it doesn't change. Number 5, kamisha, and the construct would be kamesh, and the feminine modifier would be kamesh, and the construct kamesh also with a couple of syllables. The number 6, we've got shisha, for the masculine modifier, sheshet for the construct of that, and just shesh for both the absolute and the construct for the feminine modifier. 7, we've got shiv'a for the absolute masculine modifier, shiv'a, just like your feminine getting construct. Then sheva, and sheva for the construct for the feminine modifier. For the number 8, shimona, for the absolute masculine, Shimona, and then Shimoneth, and Shimoneth for the construct. We've got the other one should be Shimona too. For number 9, Tish'ah, and then Tish'ah for the construct, and Tesha for the construct, the absolute construct of feminine. And the number 10, Asara for the feminine form, masculine modifier, and Atzeret for the construct, and then Ether, and Ether for the feminine modifier, both absolute constructs. So, that's what you have to deal with here, that you can get a reversal of form. Don't ask me why. I haven't even been able to imagine a theory for that one yet. The absolute forms normally precede the noun, which is in the plural. So if you're going to use the absolute forms, they're normally in front of the noun. So if you want to say seven women, it'd be Sheva Nashim, seven men, Shiva Anashim. Seven cows, Sheva Parot, and 7 days, Sheva Yamim. Okay, or Shiva, Sheva Yamim. The construct forms are used before the noun, which may be either definite or indefinite. So you can have Shiloshet Anashim, or Shiloshet Ha'anashim, for three men or the three men. If you have a specific three men involved, you can go ahead and put the article on it. It doesn't mean quite the same thing as without the article before, but the number three will still appear before it. Well, three men, if you want to say three men came, you're kind of introducing a new, it's just describing that if it was the three men, then the B three men usually would refer to some three men that we were talking about previously in the context.
I'm referring to the absolute construct.
Oh, the absolute. Oh, I see. The difference between absolute construct. There's apparently no difference in meaning. I think the construct is more a three of men, and maybe it's got just a slightly different connotation. In English, we wouldn't make a difference.
So you could do either one if you're going
from right. Hebrew. Yeah, if you're going from English to Hebrew, you can do either choose either construct or absolute. Okay, numbers may occur before collected nouns in the singular. The collected noun is going to be able to take numbers. Normally, any noun that's got a number on it can be plural. And if it's not plural in number, it's certainly plural in sense. And so that's what happens with these collected nouns. So bakar, is singular form, but you can have shiv'ah bakar, seven cattle, seven head of cattle, is kind of the idea. In other words, seven individuals of the collective group. And whatever those individuals would be called, you know. So then you have Shiv'ah Lechem, seven bread, you know, but we would say seven loaves of bread, seven, you know, units of some sort. And then Shiv'ah Rechem. Rechem means chariotry. And so if you've got seven chariotry, that doesn't make any sense. So seven units of chariotry is what we're talking about, okay? So collective nouns will take numbers like this, they'll take plural numbers, even though the noun form will not change its form, it will still stay singular. Okay, now we already had numbers 1 and 2. We had echad, and we had, you know, the dual form for number 2 and so forth. So we're okay on those. Now we'll go from 3 to 10. Now, later on, they'll be adding more numbers, so we'll see what they do in building on this. I think it comes for a while. They stick in numbers every once in a while. We're going to do the next chapter. But it'll be coming by and by. All right. Vocabulary, this chapter, got kate, meaning end, the kate at the end of, usually about some time toward the end of the third time. We've got katset, means end, border, or outskirts. That's the same kind of an idea, more of a spatial relationship, but it can be either time or space. Mik say at the end of either about time or place. We've got para, meaning cow or heifer. We've got safa, meaning lip, edge, or language. So it's quite a range there, lip, edge, or language. So you can see the edge is kind of taken from the sense of a lip as far as a physical object, as a border or something, border of the mouth. But then language is picking up on the fact that lip was used for speech and so forth, and my tongue would be in English. Then we've got katam, we've had that idea before as an adjective, a white person. At least we saw an example, maybe we never had a vocabulary. And yaor means the Nile, usually with the article, and then a river in general. So, in other words, what's happening is that the Nile was called the river. In other words, the word for river, and then the Nile was the river. So if you see it in the context of Egypt or something, and see where the article is probably referenced to the Nile, but if you see it, it can also be used just to describe any river in general. Okay, then you've got yakat, which doesn't occur in the perfect, but yikat in the imperfect. That means to wake up. It's not attested in the perfect. Interesting. Nobody ever woke up in the past tense. Okay. It's probably just because in the narratives it's always used as in a walk of tattoo. So, it's convenient in the form. Okay, any questions so far? Exercises. I told you yesterday which ones to do today. Okay, so the odd ones in part A. We'll maybe get started here with Doug. Take the first one there. Number one, part A.
People?
Yes, the afflicted people, or the smith people. Right. Number three, Jim.
Hakeli Sheburi.
Okay.
the remaining vessels.
Okay, Shabar means to...
smash. The destruction of the vessels.
Yeah, the destroyed vessels, the smashed vessels. Vessels look smashed. Okay. And notice you've got the plural form on that one. I'm sure we're... You started out Shabur, and then if we get adding the suffix on, you get the proper connection. Shaburi. So it's just like in any other parts of the language. Okay, number five. Criminals or bad men.
Right. But I think it's the evil criminals, cursed.
Yeah, cursed. Arurs.
Oh.
Arars to curse. So
I saw two same words.
Okay. From Arar to curse, and so it's Arurim with the accursed. The accursed criminals or the cursed criminals. Criminals that were cursed or have been cursed. Okay, number seven, Peter.
103. Shalua.
Okay.
The sent Egyptian?
Yes, the sent Egyptian, or the Egyptian who is sent or who was sent. Okay, number nine, Daniel.
Asir Asur.
Okay.
The imprisoned prisoner.
Yes, that's pretty good. The imprisoned prisoner. Okay, good. And, let's see. One more point though. Notice that there's no article on Asur. The prisoner. The prisoner was imprisoned, or the prisoner is imprisoned. Prisoner is bound. Okay. That's the last bell, so we'll stop here. And next week we'll go ahead. I think we'll go ahead and finish this lesson first and then do our review because we have a question.
Yeah, I'm looking at that.
They're talking to you with your name.
Oh.